The battle over the future of the World Cup is heating up. Arsene Wenger's been sent out to present the case for FIFA.
What fans demand today is meaningful games, and we want to respond to that expectation.
There's opposition from FIFA's Men's World Coach of the Year, Liverpool's Jurgen Klopp.
It's all about money. That's how it is.
There's also resistance from England's new women's team manager, Serena Wiegmann.
I think when you have two World Cups every 2 years, that's too much for the players.
And UEFA's president, Alexander Seferin, is threatening a boycott of the World Cup if FIFA forces through its revolution.
We cannot play. We will decide soon about the Euro 28. How can you play the World Cup and Euro the same year?
Hello and welcome to Sport Unlocked, the podcast digesting the week's sports news and trying to explain some of those complexities behind the headlines. Coming up later on, we'll talk through the cricketing controversies of the week with Elizabeth Ammon from The Times. Why did India withdraw from the final test against England over the coronavirus issues? And also those findings from the racism report from Yorkshire. But we're turning first of all to the world of football politics, and we're going to be hearing interviews and discussions with Arsene Wenger now at FIFA. We've also got Jill Ellis, the Women's World Cup winning former US coach, Serena Wiegmann, the current England Women's National Team manager, also the UEFA president, Alexander Seferin, and they're all talking about the big row over biennial World Cups. So joining me, Rob Harris from the Associated Press, as ever, Tariq Panja from the New York Times and Martin Ziegler from the Times. And Tariq and Martin, you're both out in Switzerland, where it's been a busy week of UEFA and European Club Association meetings.
How are we doing, Rob? Yeah, we're on the shores of Lake Geneva in Nyon. It's been a sort of very busy week of football politics, some fairly feisty stuff as well.
Yeah, absolutely. We've had the European Club Association meeting Monday and Tuesday. The leagues are also in town, and there is that much anticipated UEFA convention.
I seem to have had it far lighter than I was at the Sport Industry Awards on Wednesday night in Battersea in London. What was perhaps most remarkable about that was being back in a room with 1,000 people plus, all indoors, as if there was no COVID. But they did have measures that actually I've not really seen at any sporting event before of any sort, which was you not only had to be double vaccinated, a definite requirement, but also negative test then as well.
Rob, handshakes or fist bumps, any awkwardness when you encounter people? What did you go for?
It was full handshakes all round, kissing on both cheeks. It was full normality.
Well, I think it's been a bit of a mixed bag out in Switzerland. Some people happy to go for the full handshake or even a small hug. Other people, it's very much a fist bump or even a couple of elbow bumps.
Also, the football handshake was in force, I noticed. You may have seen, Rob, you're familiar with that, that little handshake for peace style.
clasping,
maybe one or two taps on the back as well.
Well, there's not much peace around this. There are probably a few people who'd want to throw a few punches at the moment rather than kiss each other in football, will they? Yes, certainly it's been a week of battles. Even throughout the 33 episodes we've been recording this pod now, we've got used to clashes between football executives. But this seems a really monumental one that's brewing, isn't it, over the future World Cups? Because we've finally heard some details from Arsene Wenger, from Gianni Infantino on plans for biennial World Cup being presented this week. And really, the rifts are growing, aren't they?
Yeah, we had Arsene Wenger in Qatar with a load of FIFA legends, the former players who've been all flown out there to basically, it seems like, give their blessing to this idea of a two-yearly World Cup, to push very hard by FIFA. I actually thought he was pretty unconvincing, Wenger. For me, he didn't really answer a lot of the key questions around having a two-yearly World Cup.
Let's take a listen to one of his core arguments.
I believe if I was inside the club, I would sign with two hands for that program, because it would give me time to have the players at disposal, get their focus on what is important for the club, and overall, I would say the better separation between club and national team football would improve the quality of a concentration on both sides.
Tarek, are you convinced?
Well, I'm not convinced by the process, to be honest. That it's such a seismic thing, adding another edition of this enormous football tournament, which, let's not forget, will be including 48 teams from 2026 in the United States, Mexico and Canada. That's already enormous. And the fundamental logic for it, I'm unconvinced by it. I'm also unconvinced by the process. If we recall, this was set in train, at least publicly, by the Saudi Arabian FA president saying he liked the idea to be studied. A couple of months back, FIFA said there was going to be this thing called a feasibility study. We haven't seen anything, head nor tail, of this feasibility study, yet we've had a bunch of FAs, particularly in Africa and Asia, saying they back this idea. I know, obviously, FIFA and Wenger have been talking to these guys, but there's been no hide nor hair of the actual feasibility study. We had these legends that FIFA has on its books, Peter Schmeichel, Tim Cahill of Australia, and Ronaldo, the Brazilian great, who's appeared, I think, in a number of World Cups, one famously in 2002, talk it up as well. And again, we've had players who are not in this legends group, notably Gareth Bale, who's never played in the World Cup, say the idea of a biennial World Cup is a terrible idea because it diminishes the special status of this.
That was perhaps surprising from him, and we can hear now from the Wales captain, Gareth Bale.
Yeah, not something I really like. I like the tradition of every 4 years. It has that prestige of, it's like an Olympics comes around every 4 years. It just feels that a little bit more special. It's not happening too often. And yeah, for me, I don't really like that. That every 2 years, I feel like it loses that bit of kind of history and the speciality, the fact that it's over 4 years and it's a long time to the next one, and it does make it that bit more prestige, I think.
Yeah, I asked the players today on this press conference with Wenger, was there any dissenting voice, a single one in the 80 that are wined and dined and bought to Qatar by FIFA? And they said no. I find that really strange how in this enormous group of characters, these former players from all over the world, not a single one of them thinks this is a bad idea, which is kind of strange given there is a lot of dissent outside of that FIFA bubble.
And I asked Arsene Wenger particularly about, surely he must have encountered some legitimate resistance, some challenges to overcome. And he focused more actually on the stage of the tournament itself.
The logistics and how it can be organized is not my specialty. I will leave that to people who can do that in my place. I've just been guided by creating a program that makes football better, in my opinion. And I have no hesitation to say, yes, I'm convinced of that. And after that, all the logistics, how it can be organized, it will be down to other people.
One thing I also asked Arsene Wenger particularly was about just why are they doing this now? Why are they so focused on more and bigger competitions when, to me at least, there seems to be more pressing matters they could be dealing with, particularly things like racism in football, particularly in the last couple of years when we've had the English FA introducing a new diversity code to try to ensure there's more diverse positions in terms of those in football. We've heard nothing similar from FIFA. They just re-announced the same old policies.
Look, I've been guided, Rob, by two things. You know me well enough to know that I'm absolutely did fight my whole life against racism, and I will continue to do that.
You know, commercially, racism isn't worth an extra $3 billion. And, you know, sadly, this is the organisation of football at a global level, even maybe regional. These FAs want to have their want to feather their nest. FIFA and President Gianni Infantino has become adept, like his predecessor, Sepp Blatter, knowing what buttons to press when it comes to solidifying support from their base. The issue of racism is obviously important in society at large. It is such a toxic situation now with social media and stuff in football stadiums. Yet when it comes to courting votes in the decade or two decades I've been covering this, the issue of racism has never been one that any single candidate for any election has ever talked about as part of a platform to get votes from their members, be it on a global level or a regional level. Martin, can you think of this being an issue at all when it comes to elections?
Well, I mean, I think everybody says the same thing about racism, don't they?
It's bad.
It's bad, and then we need to do more, and that's about it. But just to go back to the two-yearly World Cup, right? You're right, it's bubbling up into a really serious battle now. Bizarrely, UEFA, for example, haven't been told about this at all. Arsene Wenger has gone public with the media. He told L'Equipe, and then he did a briefing for the world's media this week.
Multiple calls he's had time for, but he's not spoken even to the league at all. The World Leagues Forum have only just been asked to join a call of some sort. They've not had the details. We would advocate, of course, the media always finding out things first and us being told first, but even we could say, you think they should talk to the leagues and clubs at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no, it is. And so I did an interview with the UEFA president, Alexander Shefferin, this week. I asked him, he was obviously against it, and I asked him, how can you stop this?
We cannot play. We cannot play. We will decide soon about the Euro 28.
Yeah.
How can you play the World Cup and Euro the same year? And as much as I know, South Americans, CONMEBOL is on the same page.
And I know you've expressed your concern in a letter to fans about this plan for a World Cup every 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
Have you actually been approached by Arsene Wenger or UEFA, FIFA, what it actually means?
No. They didn't come. They didn't call. They didn't. I didn't get a letter or anything. I just read in the media that they are testing something, and I think it's a bad idea, because we all know that players cannot play as much. That's one thing. It's already too much, but now to play every summer 1 month tournament, I mean, for the clubs, for the players, it's a killer.
Mm-hmm.
That's one thing. Second, if it's every 2 years, it clashes with Women's World Cup.
Yeah.
It clashes with the Olympic tournament, football tournament.
Yeah.
And as I said, it's the value is precisely because it's every 4 years, because you wait for it. It's like Olympic Games. It's a huge event. I don't see our federations supporting that.
So we hear that threat of a boycott from Alexander Shefferin. Does this just look like a threat that's not to be carried out? Haven't we gone through all this before with the Club World Cup? UEFA was really resisting, so was the European Club Association. Then eventually, later in 2019, they ended up supporting the 2014 Club World Cup, played every 4 years. Of course, it's now on ice. It's not happened in part because of the pandemic, also because the financing that Gianni Infantino said would be there has not materialised. So do we actually think UEFA are going to follow through, that it's caving in the end, and actually this is just putting up some resistance to try and get something back out of it, so it's not just granting FIFA what they're trying to get?
I actually don't think it is that. I think this is actually more likely to be some sort of annoying bargaining position where FIFA try and get themselves into position where they sort of present a fait accompli to the confederations like UEFA and CONMEBOL, and then try and get something over the line that they really want, like an expanded Club World Cup or similar. So I think they're going to run into big problems. We've had Seb Coe, the president of World Athletics, has told Sean Ingle from The Guardian that lots of the Summer Olympic sports are really concerned about this. I think it's going to damage them. He thinks it's going to rub up against the Summer Olympics soon. So that's a really big issue for football. Once you come into conflict with the Olympics, then I think you are really getting yourself into serious problems.
Yeah. The IOC president has also noticed this. He hasn't been as explicit as Alexander Seferin, the UEFA president, for example. But between the lines, it's clear that he's got a big problem with this and is going to, at some point, make an intervention. And, you know, the weird thing is, if this doesn't go ahead, those 80 or so football legends who really want this to happen, what are they going to say then when FIFA, or if FIFA were to back down? What a strange situation. It would have been nice. You know what, Rob? Whether this happens or not, don't you think maybe these games that are being played should be put to the side? We have proper, transparent conversations about the future of football. Get whatever voices are needed to be in the conversation to take part openly and correctly, rather than these kind of shadow games, these bizarre spectacles that are sort of taking place now. This is one of the kind of themes of the Gianni Infantino presidency, unfortunately. Kind of these ideas that sort of appear as though this is not me, this is the FA is asking for them, you know, let's just have a conversation, and then present it as a fait accompli. I just think people should be a bit more grown up, talk about what they want clearly, properly, and have a robust discussion rather than the kind of mess that we find ourselves in time and again.
Aren't FIFA conflating here the issues with the international match calendar and biennial World Cup plans, rather than looking at one issue at a time? So stepping back, first of all, looking at what are the challenges with the match calendar as they are now. It's a calendar that's set in place until 2024, agreed with the organisations like the European Club Association. So I would imagine they should have done a feasibility study that looked at what are the challenges of international football, what should we do with qualifying, what should we do with tournament, and it should have analysed, does the status quo work? And then that could have reported back to actually just look at all the different scenarios, and that could have produced a multitude of different situations that Wenger could have then taken into the next stage of the consultation study, rather than as we are now, the end point seemingly, where they're saying the plan is biennial World Cups, now let's consult on those. And just to run through how the international calendar does currently work, obviously we have those international breaks in March, June, July, often for the tournaments, September, October and November. Clearly, I think there are too many, particularly September, October, November. They seem to come along so often, so condensing those into some form does have some merits to it. But what came to mind to me is players can break into squads through the year. They have multiple chances based on how they're doing for their clubs. Just look at some of the players who featured and starred for England at the Euros. Calvin Phillips, Declan Rice, players who weren't necessarily even in Gareth Southgate's plans a year before the tournament, of course, when it was originally due to be played, but for the pandemic. So there is a need to look at the calendar again. Clearly, there are too many matches that aren't necessarily meaningful. The qualifiers are really predictable. FIFA does have a point there. But are they conflating the discussions on changing qualifiers with suddenly needing biennial World Cups?
100%. I think that needs to be decoupled. When we spoke to Wenger, Chance said, I think it's a great idea that calendar discussion is a correct one. There are too many meaningful games. A lot of these international games are a big turnoff to a lot of fans, to a lot of people watching on television as well. Maybe they could rationalise those, make something more interesting, and that is in their power. And I think they'll have a lot of support if they come up with something that is sensible and works for everyone. But that's nothing to do with the two-yearly World Cup. By the way, feasibility studies, FIFA has a bit of previous in this. Let's not forget that the World Cup has been expanded to 48 teams after a feasibility study that was conducted by FIFA said that the most optimum number of teams is actually the current 32 teams. It said the status quo creates the best tournament. Yet we've gone up to 48 teams after a feasibility study because, you know, the people at the top of FIFA, the Infantino, etc., wanted those. 48 teams, yes, gives 16 more teams a chance to be at the World Cup, but that also solidifies maybe support politically from 16 more federations plus others who might see themselves having a better chance.
I thought there was something that Arsene Wenger said, which I thought was quite telling. He said, I was asked by 166 countries to do a feasibility study to see how we could stage a two-yearly World Cup, not if we should stage a two-yearly World Cup. that he was clearly approaching it from a position where he was already made his mind up, and let's see how we can do it. But yeah, I agree with your thing. This idea about maybe only having two international breaks, one in October, one in March, I think there is merit in that. And again, too many qualifiers is probably that's probably something that should be looked at as well. How the national associations would take the fact that they have less money spinning home games is something that would have to be addressed, because I think that's obviously going to be important to them in terms of their finances, which is the button that FIFA are trying to push to get this tournament across the line, this two-yearly tournament across the line.
We do need to cut through some of this pretense, because they keep on pushing about the role of the Congress in May in approving this feasibility study, as if it just came out of the blue from Saudi Arabia, the proposal, that is. We know Gianni Infantino had already talked up plans for biennial World Cup. He'd already had Wenger working on it. Arsene Wenger was already working on plans for biennial World Cup before the Saudi proposal came in. So it is a pretense to suggest that this is driven by the Saudi FA. They were merely the vehicle to put it on the agenda at the Congress. And then, of course, if you present this to the Congress, there's very little dissent. Most of those countries never qualify for the World Cup. So many, obviously, are in thrall of Gianni Infantino. Although, you know, this can sound like we're complaining about, we don't like this type of democracy. We prefer a different democracy. Is that, do we look like we're just sort of complaining about the system because it's not getting the outcome that seemingly Europe might not want?
It's like, there's two things. It's completely embarrassing that there's a sham process going on. That's one thing. Where the outcome is, you know, I also understand FIFA already has conducted studies, commissioned studies, maybe just long ago, 2 years ago, into biennial World Cups, and has had some results from those. So, you know, it clearly has been on the radar. The idea that this thing is just shot up because Saudi Arabia, and then supported by a bunch of FAs, wanted a study is ludicrous. And I think it doesn't do FIFA well in terms of its sort of perception outside of FIFA House when it conducts its business like this. Just be clear and transparent about what you want to do. And then in terms of what are we being, you know, people are being European focused or not European focused, that gets to the heart of the decision making. This is going to be an important seismic change should it take place, right? It's going to affect not just these national FAs or the World Cup. It affects every part of the football pyramid almost, you know, leagues, clubs all around the world. But what we're having is that this decision is, at the moment, going to be in the hands of 211 FAs. And I noticed there was a statement, I'm just going to pick these four teams out, or, you know, with Bangladesh, Nepal, Sri Lanka, and another one the other day, saying they're completely in support of this. Now, is it right and correct that Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, Nepal, etc., have this enormous sway and say over the future of football when leagues around the world, be it in Europe, Asia, or Africa, have no say? Clubs around Europe, Africa, Asia have no say. Shouldn't we be talking about the decision-making mechanism as well when things like this happen?
But I'd also flag some issues with the IOC decision-making system, where they have the membership deciding on Olympic hosts and new sports and things like that. But actually, you can get some countries represented multiple times, often by a princess, and other countries not represented at all. In fact, football wasn't even represented for a time before Gianni Infantino gained his IOC membership. So there are issues across all sports with how the decision-making process is set up.
Well, athletics wasn't represented for quite a long time, which is remarkable given it's the sort of blue ribbon sport of the Olympics. But yeah, I mean, there does seem in football and in other sports to be this sort of desire to change things almost for change's sake. And I mean, a lot of it is about power and money and influence. And we've seen something this week in rugby union, the launch of this idea for a 12-a-side game, rugby 12s. So instead of playing 15-a-side or 7-a-side as they do in the Olympics, this is a new 12-a-side game with Ian Ritchie, the former RFU chairman. He's heading this up. He's looking for franchises. It's just, to me, it just seems like Either you're going to kill the 15-a-side game or you're going to kill the 7-a-side game. And for what? For what reason? Why would you think a 9-a-side football competition would be particularly popular? A lot of these ideas just don't make sense.
And of course, the issue with creating new rugby union formats is that rugby is actually also trying to grow the women's game too, but this would be squeezing that for space as you try to create new men's formats. And a thing that we haven't really talked about that's so important as the impact of having biennial World Cups is Arsene Wenger's only talking about men's tournaments. He's not considered at all the impact on the women's football structures, particularly if you do have men's tournaments every year, because Wenger is also suggesting continental tournaments every 2 years, those years when you don't have a men's World Cup. Currently, of course, the women's World Cup is in odd-numbered years. These plans could certainly see the men encroaching even more into women's football territory.
What I understand, the thinking is, oh, we could have the Women's World Cup held at the same year as men's or the Euros, but at a different time of the year, which, I mean, that's like pushing the women's game aside, as far as I can make it.
And there are concerns within the women's game. I was speaking during the week at Wembley to the New England women's team manager, Serena Wiegman, who reached the final of the World Cup in 2019 with the Netherlands losing to the United States. She's also European champion from 2017. And she's not a fan of these plans.
Well, I think in Europe we have a very good competition. So the Euros are great. The World Cup is great. The Olympics are great. So the three tournaments. I think when you have two World Cups in every 2 years, that's too much for the players at the moment. So I wouldn't be cheering for it right now.
Tarek, were you surprised to hear her opposed to biennial World Cups? We thought there might be more space in the calendar for more frequent women's World Cups.
I think I've been banging the drum for this. I think the women's game being modelled on the men's game is not correct. It just seems like the lazy way of approaching what essentially is a blank canvas. We've seen with the women's game where there's enormous popularity when there are these regional or international tournaments, World Cups, Olympics, Euros. They get a lot of interest. There is no reason I haven't seen why there shouldn't be that, why it has to be exactly the same as the men's competition. But I think there's a wider issue here, one of governance in women's football and the way they kind of talked about the impact on the Women's World Cup or women's tournaments as an afterthought speaks to that in my mind. That, we'll just shove it to another time of the year. Don't worry about it. Well, let's just focus on the men's football. It just sort of solidifies in my mind that the running of women's football should be separate, away from inside FIFA, the institution. There should be an organisation solely and wholly responsible for women's football. Maybe there should be a levy on men's football initially, a tax of some kind that funds this organisation in the first few years, maybe 15, 20 years even, and then let these people focus on the game, allow it to grow organically in the way they think is the right way, rather than this top-down approach from an institution like FIFA, who, let's be honest, will be focused always more on developing and growing men's football because that is the cash cow for them.
Arsene Wenger's title is FIFA's Chief of Global Football Development. It was only in the last week we discovered, actually, he's Chief of Men's Global Football Development because they appointed Jill Ellis, the US World Cup winning coach who collected the trophy in 2015 and 2019, as the lead advisor on women's football. So only, it seems now, are they starting to analyse even those plans for biennial World Cups for women. And it turns out Arsene Wenger and his team have only been looking at the men's World Cup. So all the legends that were pushed out in Doha on Thursday, they were all men. And Jill Ellis actually did a media call at the start of the week. And this is what she had to say when I put it to her about this.
I'm aware that, you know, there is ongoing conversations on the men's side, but I think similar, you know, they're probably looking at a lot of different things in terms of enhancing the landscape. You know, one of the things that I said to FIFA is like, listen, there can't be a major championship played on the women's side on the same day as the men's side, you know, so just simple calendar alignment and working it cooperatively so that both, you know, both the women and the men's sports can stand tall. I think those types of things are important. So that's looking at the scope of the calendar and within that, will probably come the discussion on the frequency of world championships. World championships, you know, they're just massive focus points in terms of just elevating our game, you know, not just in terms of the economic drivers of sponsors coming to the table, but, you know, I think probably participation increased, you know, after major world events. So there's a lot of reasons for us to dig into, you know, to what makes sense, but that's still, that'll be part of the conversation and part of the focus group's task.
And actually, just part of that, 2 points from it. One is the a wider issue of tournament names that you'd like to see an end, so Women's World Cup doesn't sit as the only one with a gender identification. And
let's just call it the World Cup. You good with that? I'm just kidding.
Yeah. If there was to be, as we've seen, these World Cups every 2 years, it means there'd be a continental championship every 2 years. So the men in particular would have a tournament every year. Would that take away then from the women's tournaments in the summer, in terms of, whereas now odd numbers of years are owned by women's football, even numbered years are more men's football in terms of the calendar? And is that something to consider about having the space to ensure you're not consumed by the still dominant men's football?
Yeah, I think that's going to be, you know, the strategic alignment that's needed, you know, because that it doesn't exist right now, right? When you suddenly have a major, I think it was like three major finals on one day, I think happened in the same day as the World Championship. But that's what I think, you know, the commitment is here is to, not just to have us stand tall, but to make sure that we are, you know, seen on in our environment as the showcase piece when we're playing a major world championship or a major world event. So I think that's going to be part of the conversation in the calendar. And I think, you know, I don't think we've really looked at it in depth of how they fit in pieces. This is what I have comfort and confidence in, is that our world championships, the female events, are becoming so increasingly popular that, you know, I think as long as it's not aligned on the same day, I think we, regardless of what year they fall in, I think they're still going to be major drivers and major world events, you know, because I think the women's game has made a massive step forward in that regard. And I think this actually, looking at this, my hope and my goal from this exercise will be, how do we even ensure that even more? And that's part of the conversation. With advisory panel and with FIFA.
Is there a discussion also whether or not something like women's football needs a completely separate entity, almost a subsection of FIFA, because actually there's too much for one FIFA to be looking at all the objects at the same time, and that attention needs to be given in terms of club game, the international game, but actually whether you need different parts, different pillars of governance.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I can't speak to the governance piece, but what I would do is, and put my coaching hat on at the moment, is, you know, as the head coach, there was a lot of things to have oversight on, right? The detail of a set piece to the medical staff, and you try and do that, but you've also got to empower people within there to do their jobs. So, you know, the way I would look at it is, I don't know that there needs to be complete separation. I just think that there needs to be. You know, and I think this is a big, massive step in towards that, right? Is to, you know, what I love here is, and this is what I did with my staff, is like, I want to hear, I want to listen. And that's basically what I think FIFA said. Hey, Jill, listen, we want you to get people together. We want to hear, we want to understand these perspectives. And now from there, we can make recommendations. So I think that this is a really positive step, you know, for me, in terms of just trying to, I don't think, my personal opinion is we are a different landscape, but I think we are the family of football. And so does it need to be completely different? No, it just needs to mean that our expertise is heard and the attention is given to it.
So Jill Ellis isn't exactly backing the idea, but what do we think about the fact FIFA's only now just sort of thinking about the consequences for women's football and seeming very much an add-on?
Well, I mean, I think, as we've all said, it's just seems to have been skated over completely. Arsene Wenger, I think, was quite uncomfortable on that front, actually, and rightly so.
Not all journalists are completely resistant to the plans. There are some showing some sort of support. Mark Dogden from ESPN tweeting, the current World Cup four-year cycle was devised in the 1920s, so probably worth an attempt at bringing it into the 21st century.
Yeah, Mark is allowed to be wrong.
No, but in seriousness, there were some of the ideas that we've talked about. Some parts of the ideas about the calendar, and we mentioned it here earlier just now, aren't awful. Like rationalising the player release dates. So, you know, Robin, you and I probably disagree with this. I think Wenger probably has a point when he talks about the breaks in the season disrupting league games. For me, as a spectator, especially this year, we've had a year and a half of no fans inside football stadiums because of this global pandemic. It was so exciting, certainly being someone based in the UK, following the Premier League, for example, to see those stadiums full of supporters and things coming back to normal. And then, you know, after the three match days, this abrupt stoppage, just as, you know, you're so excited about the new season taking shape. And, you know, players whisked to God knows where in a 10-day, two-week gap. Speaking of gap, we don't even know how long this gap is this time because of all the tensions over player release between FIFA and the CONMEBOL, for example, and the European leagues.
Well, FIFA are hopeful of getting more of a solution in place for the October window. They did manage to ease those tensions with the Premier League clubs towards the end of the week by the fact that they did lift that threat of a five-day ban on the players who'd not been released to go and play for red list countries. So FIFA did manage to strike some agreement, get them to back down the Brazilians, the Chileans, the Mexicans and the Paraguayans, and ensured they wouldn't trigger that five-day ban from players who weren't released on international duty playing for their clubs again. Of course, we had the concerns in the Premier League clubs that they didn't want to release players to red list countries who'd have to quarantine for 10 days on their return to England unless they went to a third country first before coming back to England, but then they're still unavailable for 10 days. And of course, there was that collective position with all Premier League clubs saying they wouldn't release their players to red list countries. Aston Villa, though, did break from that pact by allowing Martinez and indeed Buendia to go and play for Argentina. The Tottenham duo, Lo Celso and Romero, did seem to go on their own accord. And then they were caught up in those chaotic scenes in Brazil on Sunday night when Brazil's game against Argentina was halted after 7 minutes because the Brazilian health agents went onto the pitch to confront the Argentines who'd been in England in the previous 14 days because that was a breach of Brazilian quarantine regulations. And now there's claim and counterclaim, the Brazilian FA and the Argentine FA both being investigated by FIFA. So many documents floating around relating to this. Did the Argentines falsify their quarantine declaration papers when they arrived in the country? Had they not said they'd been in the UK in the previous 14 days? That's been investigated by the Brazilian police. Were the Argentines expecting the Brazilians to sort out all their coronavirus waivers so they could actually play? What did the Brazilians say? What did CONMEBOL know? Because CONMEBOL were involved in these discussions in the couple of days before the game about the quarantine status of the Argentines, because they arrived in Sao Paulo on the Friday. The game wasn't until the Sunday, and there were talks between the Brazilian health agency and the Argentine delegation across the weekend. Seemingly, they couldn't confront the players before the match, and that's why they entered the stadium, went in onto the pitch, stopped the game, and chaos ensued. Chaos that will now have to be unpicked by FIFA to decide culpability and just what happens to the World Cup qualifier that lasted only a few minutes before being suspended.
I mean, it's a really, really strange situation in Brazil that if you're a Brazilian travelling from England, you don't have to quarantine. Probably maybe having a Brazilian passport prevents you from getting COVID. But if you're an Argentinian player, then you do have to. So, I mean, that's a bizarre thing for a start. I mean, the Argentinian FA are saying that, you know, they've got emails saying that they, you know, that they were in negotiation about this, and it was only 30 minutes before kickoff before the health authority tried to sort of block them, the players taking part. As for them walking onto the pitch, I mean, you lived in Brazil for a long time, Tarek. Probably par for the course, do you think?
Felt completely in keeping with some of my experiences there. And no, but it's ludicrous. It's humiliating for South American football, for Brazil, for Argentina. That game as seismic. This game is Brazil versus Argentina. You don't have to live in South America to realise that it's one of the great sporting spectacles. and you have a dude in jeans with a piece of paper in his back pocket walking onto the pitch confronting Argentine players from the health ministry. This is just kind of Banana Republic territory. This is not a good look for football or for South America. But you do have this occasionally this theatrics in the region. I remember a few cases, particularly, I just moved there in 2013, and they were inaugurating the reformed Maracanã Stadium, which was reformed for the World Cup in 2014. And England was going to be Brazil's opponent for this friendly game to inaugurate the stadium. And while England were in the air, they were flying from London to Rio de Janeiro, a judge, a minor judge, had basically said the game was off. He condemned the stadium and said the game couldn't go ahead. There was an appeal then that started taking place. And I just arrived to live in the country and I thought, oh my God, this is insane. But people who live there would say, well, yeah, this is completely normal. I think that decision, while England were flying, went from playing cancelled to playing again in the space of that flight. And I just don't know how you can live on your nerves like that if you're trying to organise football tournaments and games or stadium inaugurations. It was a real black mark for the region. And it must be really annoying if you're FIFA, because you're in this negotiation with these European clubs. You're trying to have a good faith negotiation, trying to come up with a solution to what is a, you know, extremely difficult problem. And then you see this, these people storming the pitch. Of course the clubs are going to say, well, we told you so.
I don't think we've seen the last of this issue either, because, as you said, we've got the international breaks in October and in November, and the clubs are completely up in arms over this fact that they're gonna, some of their players aren't going to be allowed to play in domestic league games. Premier League been trying to sort it out. The European Club Association trying to sort it out. The government, it looks like they may do something about the exemptions for the next window, but they're certainly not going to do anything immediately to sort this particular issue out. So that's another complete and utter fiasco.
So as if there weren't enough conflicts in football, there's another one that's re-erupted this week between Paris Saint-Germain and La Liga, this particularly after the La Liga president Javier Tebas, very familiarly, had a go at state aid, benefiting clubs like PSG from Qatar, but he also had a dig about them signing Lionel Messi, clearly bitter about losing him from La Liga, basically talking about the French league being a league for old players. Lionel Messi's still only 34. He was top scorer at the Copa America as Argentina won it in July, top scorer in Spain in last season, as well as Barcelona finished third. And we had a letter from PSG to Tebas really complaining about his conduct.
Yeah, accused him of lack of respect. Quite funnily, of course, Tebas and the PSG president, Nasser Al-Khelaifi, were due to speak on the same platform at this European convention. And there was certainly some sort of frosty relations when this came out, with the knowledge that they're going to have to see each other. But I spoke to Nasser Al-Khelaifi after they had met each other, and I said, what was the relationship like? And he said, well, it was fine, we shook hands, but he did give a sort of knowing smile that this is not going to be the end of this particular battle.
I think they were also both sort of advised, maybe not warned, might be strong, like in their opening remarks at this convention, to sort of keep it civil, because, you know, Nasser Al-Khelaifi, which is one of the issues, wears several hats. And he was at this UEFA convention, not as the PSG president, but as the president of the European Club Association, representing 200 European teams. And it's awkward. Oh, another awkward bit between Tebas and Khelaifi is the fact that Khelaifi, his company, BeIN Media Group, hands over millions of euros to Tebas's La Liga in television rights. So it's funny that they're swapping these letters about bad language and intemperate behaviour, etc. But at the same time, Mr. Al-Khelaifi is a customer of Mr. Tebas's television rights, and Mr. Tebas receives all of this cash. And that talks about, I suppose, a kind of strange world of football. it's like, you know, these Venn diagrams where they all seem to cross over in different guises.
And of course, this week we did have Nasser Al-Khelaifa doing a press conference at the European Club Association. Although strangely, we did have Al-Khelaifa saying that he was there to represent the ECA, not PSG or Qatar, even though the fact the only reason he's ECA chairman is the fact he's the president of PSG.
Yeah, I mean, the other interesting issue around the ECA and, for example, what their view would be on a two-yearly World Cup is that the FIFA meeting of all these FIFA legends is taking place in Qatar. So it possibly puts him in a tricky position if he wants to express any opposition to this, if FIFA's big show is actually happening in his home country. Other things this week, Rob, I mean, there's been obviously some more concerning news from Afghanistan in terms of sport.
Yeah, we've had a Taliban spokesperson saying that women's sport is going to be banned in Afghanistan. This only weeks after they swept back to power. They've been trying to present themselves as very much changed from the Taliban that was toppled 20 years ago. And those will renew concerns about just what rights women will have in the new Afghanistan run by the Taliban. Australia were due to host a women's cricket test against Afghanistan in November. Now, Australia's sports minister, Richard Colbeck, saying that's deeply concerning and is hoping that the International Cricket Council will take action against Afghanistan.
Yeah, is it surprising? I know a lot of people said this is a Taliban 2.0, but Taliban gone a Taliban, right? They have a certain way of living and a certain code or whatever, and it's really impossible to live there if you're a woman who wants to live in the ways they have been able to maybe over the last 15, 20 years while the Taliban have been out. It's really sad.
And obviously a challenge for FIFA as well going forward in terms of their dealings with Afghanistan run by the Taliban. They obviously do deal with North Korea, even though obviously their regime is so abhorrent to many, and yet you know, they are part of the football political community as well. They do go to congresses as well.
Yeah, it's an interesting test for FIFA. If you have a country who will not allow their women to play, I mean, we've had it, obviously we've had it with other Islamic countries in the past, but it's a really testing one for the future.
We did want to address some important cricket matters, and we did finally have the release from Yorkshire of the independent investigation that showed the former England under 19 captain Azim Rafiq was the victim of racial harassment at the county. Also, towards the end of the week, we did have England's fifth and final test against India called off with just a couple of hours' notice. That was over fears in the Indian side over potentially more coronavirus cases after an outbreak with some of their backroom staff. Well, who better to turn to get the expert view on all this than Elizabeth Ammon from The Times?
There were discussions throughout the night between the ECB and the BCCI trying to find a compromise that would see the test match continue, but 24 hours later. However, the Indian players were not accepting of those proposals to carry out further testing and tighten up the bubbles. So at 8:44, 2 hours and 15 minutes before play was due to start, the match was officially cancelled. Throughout the day then on Friday, there were a number of briefings and counter briefings about whether the series would be deemed as 2-1 with the cancellation being put down to COVID, or whether the series would be resolved as a 2-2 series draw with the Indian players having deemed to be forfeited. It matters in a sense whether it is cancelled because of COVID or whether it is deemed to have been cancelled because the Indian players refused to take the field. It matters for a number of reasons, not least the series result, but also because of insurance purposes. The ECB now face a £30 million black hole in lost broadcasting and ticket revenue because of the cancellation. The BCCI have offered to rearrange the match, and it could be tacked on to India's limited overs tour in 2022. But as it stands, it is unresolved. So we don't know what the outcome of the match is. We don't know what the result of the match is. We don't know what the result of the series is. And it will now be down to the ICC's Dispute Resolution Committee to adjourn on the matter and whether it is a drawn series and indeed who is responsible financially. for the financial losses. It should be remembered that although both the ECB and the BCCI are publicly saying that this cancellation has nothing to do with the fact that the IPL rearranged from May is starting again in 9 days, it should be remembered that back in May, the BCCI did ask for the series to either be reduced to 4 matches or for this 5th match to be moved earlier in the summer to allow time for preparation for the IPL, which is, of course, their single biggest source of income and their number one priority. It's worth £360 million to the BCCI. The Indian players were supposed to fly out of the UK on Wednesday to go to the UAE to take part, join up with their IPL franchises. They are now departing the UK and hastily rearranged flights on Saturday and will go straight to the UAE to join up with their IPL teams. It is not clear how this situation will be resolved, but it is clear that there is a huge amount of disagreement between the two boards about what the reason for the cancellation was and indeed who takes responsibility for it. It's going to be resolved, but probably not quickly, over the coming weeks. And whilst all that was going on in Manchester, with the test match being cancelled and the subsequent row brewing over that, Yorkshire at 9 o'clock on Friday morning released a summary of their report into institutional racism following allegations by former player Azeem Rafiq. They reiterated their stance that they could not release the entire 100-page report for legal reasons, but did publish a summary in which they apologised again to Rafiq for the treatment he had received whilst he was a player, and found that 7 of the 43 allegations were proven, and most of the others were either unproven because evidence suggested that they that there was nothing in those allegations, or because there was limited evidence that meant that the panel couldn't make a decision one way or the other. It is both interesting that Yorkshire, although they had pre-planned to release this on Friday morning, didn't then take the decision to just postpone whilst the test match was going on, which it would have been, or indeed once they'd heard that there was chaos at Old Trafford, cancellation chaos at Old Trafford, that they didn't then postpone their announcement. It does, on the face of it, looks like they were trying to bury bad news, whether that is or isn't the case. More interestingly is that the ECB have subsequently released a statement saying that they have not, despite being the regulator of the game, been sent a copy of the full report and are unlikely to be, and are, reading between the lines, clearly irritated about the whole process, which has now taken an exorbitant amount of time and has been less than transparent. It is now within the ECB's gift and within their jurisdiction to charge Yorkshire with bringing the game into disrepute, if that is the course of action that they want to take. I think they will take a bit of time to assess their position, but will clearly not be fully accepting of just Yorkshire putting out a statement with a summary and a bit of recommendations, none of which look like they have particular teeth. It's certainly not going to go away, I don't think, this one. We will certainly hear more from the ECB about next steps. And I suspect that there will be some parliamentary involvement when they reconvene after recess.
We'll wait to see where those investigations go. Thanks a lot to Elizabeth Ammon, who's really got the inside track on the world of cricket news, particularly while we've been very focused on the football politics of the week. So really great to get that insight from Elizabeth, who you can read in the Times. That about draws a close to things. Tarek, Martin, what's it been like getting on the road back to some in-person UEFA meetings again after so long they've been on Zoom and we've not been able to get in the rooms?
Yeah, it's good in different ways. You get the people who used to blank you still blanking you. You get those who want to chat and have a little conversation, which is different face-to-face rather than Zoom or on the phone. People are able to maybe express themselves. And you also get the deluge of criticism from what you've written over the last few months or years. So we've had a fair bit of that while we've been on the road here.
We can set the record straight, maybe.
Yeah. It's anyway, Rob, it's been great catching up with you. Maybe one of these days we'll have a quiet week and think, what can we talk about? But we've started in January and it just seems like every week is something really, really big happens.
And it's always great to be able to discuss such a big variety of issues, to try to delve into the headlines and some of the issues that might not have got full attention, and just to distill and explain everything. Hopefully you're enjoying it. If you can send any feedback, we're at Sport Unlocked on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. And if you do hit subscribe on your podcast app, then it means we drop into your feed automatically. But for now, enjoy the sports viewing in the days ahead, and thank you for listening.